Welcome to the Online Recovery Area Celebrate Around the World 2026 event. Next up, we're speaking from Israel and Canada. It is with much love and gratitude that the group welcomes Israel to come and share with us. Israel, over to you.
Thank you, Purdy. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. My name is Israel Campbell. It's an honor and a privilege to open for Kimia. I see Kimia's name all over the internet, and I'm just grateful to be able to warm up the crowd before we get a deep and meaningful spiritual message from her. And to follow Donna, that was great. A friend of mine came on, Donna, at the end of your talk and said, "Aren't you supposed to be speaking now?" And I said, "That is me speaking. I'm a black woman." Anyway, tiptoe, right, Chris? Tiptoe, right up to the line. Purdy, I'm grateful to be here. I will admit my ego got a little involved. I wrote Purdy a message. Doesn't the person with the most time speak last? Doesn't really matter. As Donna just said, quite literally, absolutely any of us could do this. This is like more of us can clean the bathroom successfully at the meeting space than can speak, because anyone that speaks is a great example either of what we want to be doing or what we don't want to be doing, or it's everybody. The drunk, I don't know why we don't let people. My reference is Alcoholics Anonymous. I snorted the vast majority of my cocaine off the back of my high school ID card. I was not what was Al Pacino's name? I was Tony Montana. I was not falling into a pile of cocaine. I was literally, two lines each kind of guy. I drank from the age of 9. I picked up my first drink when I was 9. I put down my last drink when I was 16. I took a lot of I took any chemical that I could get my hands on. I used to say I had a drug dealer. What I really had was a fellow 11th grader who was stealing his mom's pills. So I was basically being medicated as a middle-aged woman, a middle-aged suburban woman. So I was probably taking antidepressants and anti-anxieties and diet pills and probably some estrogen thrown in. I don't think it didn't work. The estrogen didn't work because I don't have any hair on my head, but if I hang upside down, I have hair on my head. This is my red Corvette. This is my middle age. My red Corvette is hanging from my chin. What can I say? I picked up my first drink when I was 9. I was staying with my cousin. He was everything that I wanted to be. He was a liar, a cheat, and a thief. And I thought he was the coolest person in the world. And he robbed people that robbed people. He would want me to point that out. He didn't rob people. He was a do-gooder. And one night they stole a case of whiskey and a couple of cases of Carling Black Label beer. They told me I could be the bartender and open everybody's beer. Fiona's heard this so many times. She's like on her phone. She's like, "Oh, fuck that guy. He's going to throw up in his sleeping bag in a minute. Can he just get over it?" It's like the only little story. I want you to know that, like, I have been continuously sober since the 14th of February, 1980. You're like, 14th of February? That's not even a month. No, the 14th of February, 1980. My life has happened to me sober. The pain, the humiliation, the shame, it's all possible in sobriety. Don't think you're gonna, I was so afraid I was gonna be like, credit application and a sit you my ex I want to qualify, and again, I want to apologize. I didn't ask to be here. They asked me to be here. I rarely did cocaine. I know you guys blur the lines on that a lot, and I love that, and I'm not complaining about it. I'm just telling you, literally, like literally lines off my ID from my school ID. So we're not, yeah, anyway. But what I loved about that first drink and every other drink I ever took, and every pill I ever took that got me high, and every joint I ever smoked that got me high, and every pair of sneakers I ever took that got me high, and every time I ever met high, and every time I ever did anything that got me out of me was me. that I 100% believe that. Oh God, he just pulled out the book. Fuck, we're in for a long one. 26 minutes and 15 seconds, and I promise I'll stop because I won't. Want to hear? Give me a. This line in the book where it says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. My friend Michal Avram, who I don't think is here, but if he is, he would want me to say that if we take out that comma, or if we take out the first comma after that, that the true message of that line is that we think is the root of our troubles. And I think he's right. If I'm not in the midst of a spiritual experience, I have to think, right? I had to decide to come here tonight. I had to decide when I was out on my walk to come back into the house. Like, this all required thoughts. Had to put clothes on the synagogue, right? I have, like, it's thoughts after thoughts after thoughts all damn day long, right? And when I'm thinking of and by myself, I can get in trouble. Because some really, really stupid shit sounds like a good idea. And when it's such a good idea that I shouldn't share it with anyone else, then I'm really in trouble. Right? That whole section, this I think is the key to everything here. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows in the retaliation. Right? I didn't suffer like alcoholism, drug addiction, whatever you want to call it. That was a solution for my problem. The problem I had way before I ever drank. I was self-obsessed, self-centered, self-seeking in the extreme from as early as I could remember. I was stepping on the toes of others. I was, looking at what you had and what, we don't say it anymore because we've all been on Zoom for so long. But when we first got on Zoom, people used to say to the newcomers, like, oh, it's so amazing you're able to get sober in a Zoom meeting. Like, I really had to be in a live meeting and I could have never done it in my living room. And I suddenly occurred to me, like, really? Like, we all went to church basements. You can't tell me. There's very few of us, very few of us that found out the meetings were in churches and they were like, oh, thank goodness. I'm really happy that we're going to church tonight. Right? How many of us thought we might really, truly explode into flame when we walked into that first meeting because it was a church? Right? So, like, but what I was starting to go for is this whole idea of like being able to see into each other's houses. I mean, like, like, look at some of these people's houses. I'm not talking about the people that put up fake pictures beside themselves and pretend like they live on Nantucket. I'm talking about the actual people who are showing us their houses. And like, I would be, if I were new, I'd be like, oh man, I could get sober in Rochelle's house, but my house, I can't get sober with that, Like one third of that whole bookshelf is Holocaust books. Anyway, different story. This selfishness and self-centeredness that I suffered from, I suffered from way before I ever picked up my drink, my whole life. And I picked up a drink and it was a relief. It was everything that the book Alcoholics Anonymous describes as the recovery, the gifts that recovery will give you, alcohol gave me. I wasn't consumed with self. I didn't have fear. I didn't have anxiety in the way that I had. Like all of that stuff really, really, really went away. It's just that a whole lot of negative stuff started happening. Right? And that's right. I don't know if it's a good example or not. No one's ever said it is or not, but I use the example of someone that's extremely overweight and they start to run to lose weight. And it's successful. They lose a lot of weight because they're running. And then they blow out their knee. And suddenly they can't run anymore, right? Their solution went sideways and they need another solution. I took a drink when I was nine and I felt relief. But then I started waking up in other people's basements, getting punched in the face, failing at school, wetting the bed, throwing up in my sleep while laying on my back. You know, things that could really, really, really be probably falling in front of, or not in front of, but just almost in front of. One night I fell into the street and my right hand hit a car, the back of a car. So I was how many split seconds away from falling in front of that car, right? How many high school funerals did I go to of kids that drove drunk and died? Lots, few, many. I don't know. Five or six. Not thousands, But like, how many do you have to go to if it's yours? You know what I mean? You don't get to go to a second drunk driver funeral if you're in the first funeral. Right? So Clancy used to talk. Clancy Imislin, the AA member who died a number of years back, was my sponsor at the end of his life, for the last 12 years of his life. And he used to say that Alcoholics Anonymous will do for us what alcohol did. Alcoholics Anonymous will do for us slowly what alcohol did for us quickly. And the other thing he used to say that I love is that we alcoholics aren't problem drinkers. Problem drinkers stop drinking and they stop having problems. We alcoholics stop drinking and we start having problems. Right? Every day, a screw, a spring in our gut just tightens up a little bit. Every day we're sober. And then one day it's just too much and we have to pick up a drink or a drug. And that's what we do. Unless we find this program and unless we work this program. Right? This program is the spiritual solution that I found in alcohol in a healthy form. As a result of working these steps, when I'm having a spiritual experience, in my life, I've never threatened violence or been threatened with violence. I mean, as a, you know, I got mugged on the subway once and it was pretty violent, but that wasn't, you know, a lack. It was, you know what? It actually was. Because I went into the subway that night at like 3 o'clock in the morning at 181st and 4 Washington Avenue on the A line in Manhattan, and I was headed downtown. And I had this overwhelming feeling that I shouldn't be there. Like an intuitive feeling I shouldn't be there. And what did I do? I should have left. And if I had left, I would not have the story I'm about to tell you, and I wouldn't know that my intuitive feeling was correct. But what I did instead was check to see, because they would post if the trains weren't running in a certain direction. And I checked, the trains were still running. And I went down to the platform. And I waited about 15 minutes and I had a second overwhelming intuitive feeling to leave. And I didn't leave. And I got on the train. I got on the train at the end of the train. There's no personnel in the end of the train. They're in the middle of the train, the front of the train. And 15 seconds out of the station, these three black kids came in from the next car. And as they passed me, one said, "What are you looking at, motherfucker?" And I thought I should have answered, "My life passed before my eyes." But I didn't think of that. And he grabbed me around the neck, fractured my larynx, which I didn't learn for another month because I refused to go to a doctor. Second guy punched me in the face, knocked me out, stole my money. Da, 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 da. I was on my way to speak at the Oklahoma State Young People's Conference in 1988. I arrived, and they took my watch, they took my wallet, they didn't take my airplane ticket back in the day. You know, I hate when people do. Don't you hate when the old timers go, "Wow, well, when we got sober, you know, we didn't have electronic tickets. We had a paper ticket. You had to know what your ticket was." Right? The one I love is like, "We didn't have coffee cups. We put the coffee grounds in our mouth and we drank boiling water." Yeah, that's what we did when we got sober. But whatever. I survived. I got out of the cop wanted me to go to the hospital. I said no. I said, "You know, I have a plane to catch in like 4 hours." He said, "You probably won't make it." I said no. Got on the plane, went to my friend's house in Oklahoma, slept for like 8 hours. His wife was a nurse. She came home. She's like, "You let him go to sleep with major head trauma?" And I survived. I spoke at the conference. hooked up with the chairwoman of the conference. It was great. Those were the days, the good old days when I was young and cute. I know I'm cute now, but I'm cute in like a garden gnome kind of way. Then I was just flat out cute, right? Like now you got to have like a kind of freaky fetish to like what I look like. But then I was just adorable. I promise you, no, imagine a full head of hair, no beard. I know I look like a garden gnome. I think I'm a rather attractive garden gnome, but then I was adorable. People love to fuck me. I mean, to work out their own stuff, you know? And I'm willing to help, you know? I'm one of those guys that wants to help. Anyway. This program, these spiritual principles, and they're all spiritual principles. I want to say that. Like I'm not a I'm not I'm certainly not a technician. I'm not going to take you through the steps in the 15 minutes I have left. I have no interest in convincing you to work the steps I do. I have no I'm not here to say that it says as the result of these steps. It doesn't say the result. It says the result. It might mean the only result, but I doubt it. We're talking about spiritual principles. I want to. I'm not saying don't work the steps, and I'm not saying don't work the steps as quickly as you possibly can. Please don't hear. Don't go to your sponsor and say, "Well, this guy Yisrael, he said, you know, I don't have to work the steps, and I certainly don't have to work the spiritual principles." That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying having a commitment is also a spiritual principle. Cleaning up a coffee cup that you didn't spill is also a spiritual principle. You know, having a home group, showing up every week, you know, calling the newcomer back, taking their number and calling them. All spiritual principles. Again, I think what sometimes happens is people are so, the phrase that jumps to mind is afraid to have a spiritual experience. But I think having a spiritual experience is, you know, it's hard to kind of grasp. It's hard to hold on to. It's hard to know if you're having one, right? It's much easier to know if you've written out your fears. It's much easier to know if you've written out your powerlessness. It's much easier to know if you've written down the characteristics of the God you believe in or the God you don't believe in. But that's not what's in the book, right? The book, there's 103 pages in the book dealing with the 12 steps. 62 of them, plus the doctor's opinion, the forewords and the introductions and all that. But let's just, for sake of this discussion, say 62 of them and the doctor's opinion are geared to the first two steps. But there's nothing to do there. Right? If your sponsor tells you to write out your powerlessness, you can write out your powerlessness, but and that may very well work for them, and it may very well work for you and all the people you ever sponsor. But that's not what the book asks you to do. The book asks you in 62 pages, which is roughly 62% of the steps in terms of volume, right? Two steps are Cameron, was I supposed to wear a black tie? Shit. I had a tuxedo on and I thought, you know, first of all, you can't see my bow tie. I might, in fact, have a bow tie on, right? So there's no point in wearing me. And secondly, I thought I'd be overdressed. I mean, if Ralph White's in a t-shirt, why should I have to wear a bow tie anyway? Okay. So 62 pages are aimed at two steps, and at the end of those, right, it's the ABCs. Right? The ABCs are what the cumulus of all of those 62 pages. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and that God could and would if he were sought. Being convinced of those three things, we are now at step three. I want to make one argument When it says no human power could have relieved my alcoholism, I don't think it means this. Yes, sharing with another alcoholic. Right? Because this is actually, I believe, and I've believed this for a long, 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 long time, that my first access to a power greater than myself was me and any one of you. And I think that bears out in our history, right? Dr. Bob was a doctor. That's why we call him Dr. Bob. Like an actual medical doctor. He wasn't Doc Bob, like the guy that gives medical advice. He was Dr. Bob. And Bill Wilson was a stockbroker. And I want to say before I go on, I love Bill Wilson and I love all that he gave to us. But have you ever met a stockbroker? I don't even mean, even though some of these are the same, I don't mean a stockbroker in AA. I mean a stockbroker. They are the most, in my opinion, my humble opinion, the most self-centered, materialistic, power-driven people I've ever met. All they want to do is accumulate power and money and, you know. And there's nothing wrong with that. You're free to do whatever you want in life. But this guy, this stockbroker who was sober some 6 months, goes out to Akron, right? Let's just go through that for a minute. He goes to Akron. He's staying at the Mayflower Hotel, very nice hotel. Now it's not. It's a single room occupancy hotel now. Like you want to meet someone in Akron without any feet, go to the Mayflower Hotel. They're probably sitting in front of the hotel right now. But then it was a very, very nice. And that's not to say that single room occupancy hotels aren't nice. They're very nice. When you don't have anywhere else to sleep, that's fucking fabulous. But the Mayflower in 1934, five, whenever you got there, was a nice hotel. It was the best hotel in town. And he stays there because he's Bill Wilson. And his deal goes south and he doesn't have the money to pay for the room. And he goes down to the lobby. And my understanding is he's faced with a choice. To one side is the bar, and to the other side is a phone, a public phone for the kids in the room. That's a phone. That's attached to a wall that you have to put actual money in. Right? My house, growing up, I had a mobile phone, but you had to take the whole house with you. Right? Mobile phone in my youth was the kitchen phone, which had a long cord, which if you stretched it as far as you could get it into the laundry room and close the door. But if anyone opened that door, you were going to get blasted in the face with the door. That was a mobile phone. Anyway, he's faced with this choice, bar or phone. And my understanding is he didn't want to drink. He just wanted to feel the bar. He just wanted to sit in the bar, just feel the relief of the kind of the low light and the clinking of glasses and the laughter and the smell. Nice, beautiful people. He didn't want to drink. He just wanted he's Again, his deal fell apart and he can't afford the room he's staying in. He has real problems in this moment. I wouldn't begrudge him if he just wanted to sit in a bar for an hour and gather his thoughts. But he doesn't. He goes to the phone and he calls it. The church directory is on the wall next to, like, again, I don't know Bill Wilson that well. I never met him, but I'm betting he didn't often pull out a church directory for relief. For comfort and start calling pastors and priests. But he does there. And the 10th, my understanding again, I'm not a historian, I'm no Billy Noonan. Thank God, because we already have a Billy Noonan. I'm no Gale from Akron. I'm just a humble little garden gnome in Jerusalem trying to not get hit by an Iranian ballistic missile. Anyway, that's an outside issue, man. Yeah, it is. And it'll be an inside issue when it crashes through this window. Anyway, he calls them and he asks, does anyone know an alcoholic? I need to find an alcoholic. And he gets to Bill and he gets to Bob, right? He gets to Henrietta Cyberling and she invites him out to the Cyberling estate. She's living in the guest house. It's not really called the guest house. It's a really nice house. You should go out to Akron and see it. She was not suffering. I mean, anyway. And the next, right, they call Bob and Bob's already passed out at the kitchen table, right? It's Saturday afternoon. And Anne says in that great Al-Anon voice, we can all hear it, oh, he'll be there tomorrow. Right. And in fact, he was, right? She got him up and she got him out. And I think around 5 o'clock, which was probably as early on Sunday as he could get his shit together, they're driving out to the Cyberling estate. And Bob knows Henrietta because they're in the Oxford group together, but he doesn't know Bill. And he says, and I heard this from his son at a conference in Bob Smith Jr., Smitty. I heard this at a conference in Texas in the 1980s. He was driving the car. He was a teenager. His father was drunk, hungover, and his mother was a good Midwestern woman. I don't know why she wasn't driving, but she wasn't. And his father said, we'll give this bird 15 minutes. In other words, we told Henrietta we're coming and we're going to come. We're not going to be rude. We're from Vermont and now we're Ohioans. We're good Midwestern folk. But I'm not listening to this shit. I'm a doctor. I know more about alcoholism than this guy. I'm a doctor. I'm a religious man. I'm a member of the Oxford groups. I know what I need to do. I just can't somehow seem to do it. And so they meet. Right, we'll give this bird 15 minutes. And they stayed almost 6 hours. And Bill said, Bob, I need you. I need to tell you my story so I remember what happened to me. He didn't say, Bob, I can tell you how to get sober. I know what you need to do. He said, this is what I need to do. And somehow, one alcoholic sharing their experience with another alcoholic, you might write that off. And that's where I started with all this as a human power. But I think there's something different. Something is added when we join together that is not here. It doesn't work so well in Zoom, but I guess it would work if you really had to push it. But go to your local meeting early, be the first person in the room, and sit in that room and just take the temperature of the room. And then, when everyone is gathered together and the meeting is on, and you're in the middle of the meeting and it's really cooking, take the temperature of the room again. Something is different when we gather together and when we share our experience, strength, and hope. And it really is something. And it is this idea of telling our own stories so that we each, you tell your story, and I hear my story. Bill didn't tell Bob what to do. He shared his experience. And in Bill's experience, Bob heard Bob's story. And that's why we need to be here. We need to have spiritual experiences so that we can recover from alcohol, so that the 10-step promises can come true. And alcohol, the problem has been removed. Well, if the problem's been removed, what the fuck am I doing at a meeting at 9:30 at night on coming out of Shabbat in the middle of a war? An hour ago, I got an alert that we were expecting to go into the safe rooms. I'm not sure the internet is strong enough in the safe room. The safe room is an apartment room in my apartment where the walls are extra thick, and there's a steel door that's a couple inches thick, and there's a steel plate that slides across and closes as the window. It's not, maybe I could have talked from in there, maybe I couldn't, you know? That's not the, I don't even know why I got off on that. But yeah, if I'm recovered, and I am, I mean, I know I'm not one of those people that says I'm recovered because the book talks about being recovered from a hopeless state of mind, a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Seemingly means it's not even true. And if I was saved from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, I was saved from that in my second meeting. I walked out of my second meeting filled with hope. Hope that if you were alcoholic and what I was the way you described yourself to be, and if you were alcoholic, then I was alcoholic. And if you were, and first of all, in my family, coming through the mental illnesses with alcoholism is like going to Harvard. You're doing very well in my family if you're only alcoholic. I'm not sure I'm only alcoholic, but I'm mostly alcoholic. I'm first alcoholic. You know what I mean? But I was filled with hope because you were filled with hope because you were living this process of recovery. So if that's what I've recovered from, what is that worth bragging about? That happened on February 6th, 1980. That's hardly like a win in the win column. Like I've lost jobs, I've not gotten jobs, I've had great jobs, I've chosen careers that I was not successful at. I've married twice, I've divorced twice. I have a kid in combat in the Israeli Defense Forces. I have another kid who's going to be in combat in 3 weeks in the Israeli Defense Forces. You know, like there's been a lot of wins and there's been a lot of losses, but like to call myself recovered because something happened on February 6, 1980 seems like not the thing to focus on. My challenge is to be focused on recovery, focused on service to others, focused on getting out of self when something dear to me, like my son, is in Gaza fighting a war. That's the challenge today. That's what I have to recover from, is not being totally self-obsessed and in a fetal position in my bed for the 3 weeks he was there, or any other number of things. Like not getting to do the things I really want to do, not really, you know, not getting to have the career I really wanted to have, not getting to be a famous movie star. I've not gotten a lot of stuff here. And I've gotten a lot of stuff that I could have never planned for. The life I have today, you can't get by asking for it. You have to live it one day at a time, one decision at a time, one road at a time to get from where I was to where I am. Thank you.
Thank you, Yisra. Beautiful. Kimia, over to you.
Thank you so much, Purdy, and everybody in the room, and some of our service folks who have been serving ever so beautifully and humbly behind the scenes. Some of the best service is usually done quietly, and I get to really appreciate that. Again, thank you, Purdy, for putting this day together. I get to be sharpened by a lot of people who came before me, and definitely by Israel. You are definitely, I may know a lot of stockbrokers, but you are that one garden gnome I take over all those stockbrokers. So thank you. Thank you for being here. And I want to recognize everyone who has come before me and everyone who will come after me. Hopefully they will. That will inspire others. You know, Cameron F., you know who you are to me. I know who you are to God, and may I continue to be able to walk this path with you. John E. from Netherlands, Max D. from Ireland, Kwesi from South Africa, Ella from Mexico, Peter M., yes, from UK, and Donna J. from US, and Israel from Israel. And you know, that state of war that you were just referring to, I was born in that war. I was born during an 8-year war. And I get to see that as a child who was actually taught how to find that bomb shelter first and foremost in a kindergarten. Today, I don't have to look for that shelter anymore. I get to have that safety and sanity and hopefully neutrality from a God that shelters me from a disease of a defeated self. And in that defeated self, this disease tells me that I am it. My job today is to see that that which defeats me is not me. And so I get to see the manifestations of that defeated self. This program has allowed me to see that. You guys did. And thank God for CA opening your rooms to me. Yes, physical rooms. That's where I got to recover. That's where I got to actually hear the words of recovery. And then later on, coming online, 6 years and being online, Cameron F's workshop was one of those stops in person in Toronto, where I was an absolute broken and busted and disgusted person who was just walking dead. And I got to see another fellow print workbooks, set up chairs, deal with addicts who wouldn't even sit around to gauge their attention and give that beautiful time of his to others. I get to see him do the same thing 19 years later from the inception of that workshop. It still happens online. We get to reach to a lot of people who may have never had the chance to know we exist. And I know what a privilege it is to be able to click on a Zoom room. I know there are places in this world where that privilege of internet is not widely available. or the privacy or the security to be able to be online is not there. I know the family systems and cultural rules around what that means. I know what it means to have access today. And so, yes, to have an online platform where we get to be free, we get to actually share with one another what this message actually is. That is a privilege today. And I get to see that a God way beyond my conception, it has to be a God of its own understanding for me. Because my understanding will be limited, that finite self will be limited, but a God of its own understanding, it's infinite, it's horizonless, it's boundless. It's that point where the sky meets the ocean. You know, the blue and the blue, it just goes on forever and ever and ever. And I get to learn that from those whom I have seen the existence of God within. I come from an atheist and agnostic family. The word God is not something that we throw around in my family. We don't speak of God. I speak of God, but I don't lead with the chin either. The book tells me that is actually not helpful. The job, the purpose is to be of helpfulness. Where does my helpfulness take me? This message always has a way of carrying me through that helpfulness. Just last week, I had the pleasure of being in Ireland with Purdy and doing a 12 steps in 4 hours with 150 addicts in the room. That is a miracle. Try to gauge the interest of two addicts in the room, let alone 150 people, with the youngest person being 20 and the oldest person being a grandfather who sent me a message today and said, "You are to blame for my recovery and the fact that I got a sponsor. Blame me some more. Blame me some more. That's okay." And I get to hear the beauty of the testimonies of beautiful souls that have been activated, they have been set free. So they can tell others that this freedom is also possible for them. We talk about sharing experience, strength, and hope. I want to have a better understanding of what this hope is. Israel said something very beautiful. I resonate with that. That hope is for days that are darker, that are more grim, where I'm at the grip of a disease that works through fear. You know, it says this evil and corroding feeling, this thing that my life, my existence has been shut through with, fear in its innate essence is not a bad thing. It actually gives me a fight or flight reaction to things so I can see better, I can hear better, I can act quicker. But it says, did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? What does that mean? That I set that ball rolling like I'm playing bowling? Yes, I set it rolling. I start using this fear as a recreational activity. When I say I start doing that, that's my defeated self doing that. That which defeats me. Today, I get to see that which defeats me is not me. And so, what is this hope we keep talking about? Because I hope to be able to leave this room with a 1% chance of an understanding that this is accessible to all of us. That hope embodied is an experience. Not as an abstract mental concept, but a physical present reality within the body, oftentimes during suffering or uncertainty. It's this recognition that hope in its physical sensation, like a determined resilience, like gritting teeth, clenched jaw, or paradoxically, in the surrender of releasing tension. It's a sense of presence, a grounding, a being in the now. That's sometimes a quiet, energetic, or a surrendered state. I don't resurrender anymore. Too much foolish energy is spent in the resurrendering. I stay surrendered. I stay surrendered. I know who my employer is today. I'm not about to change jobs or employers. No. And this hope that I'm talking about tonight is this centering feeling that where we cultivate a sense of purpose in the body, especially during pain or stress. And so we locate it in the realm of the mind and the spirit, something that we experience in the now. When we pay attention to it, we realize it actually resides in our bodies and our spirits. We notice what hope feels like physically. Like, take a moment and consider something that draws hope upon you. Then notice what you're feeling physically. That it's different in different circumstances. When I'm in a situation that seems devoid of possibilities, a dead end, and then I feel hope in my gritted teeth. That space between my eyebrows that closes, the core bracing. It's a survival instinct. Yet sometimes in a similar situation, staying surrendered can be the truest embodiment of hope. The tension releasing often quite tearfully, there's a manifestation. And so opportunities can feel like they're actually available there. Hope could be in that one moment of a smile. Now, wisdom behind someone's eyes when they don't even need to use language to tell me what's the path forward. And so when I experience this hope in my body, I'm able to tell you it is possible. As a person, as a type 3 addict, that once I start, I can't stop and I have no control over how much I've taken, it's possible for me to access hope. It's possible for me to be in neutrality. It's possible for me to see that God does for me and through me what I could not do for myself. That hope is a discipline. Have you ever considered that? What does this discipline mean? I actually can't see out of my one eye today, but the twinkle behind my eyes are not dimmed. That's not going to change. My vision might be limited, but my discipline will be there. And the word discipline, it really comes from the word disciple. The follower within. And for many of us, discipline implies this absence of fun, this devoid of joy, like being in school and sitting still and enduring discomfort in some form or another, and then associating that with discipline. Even as adults, we create areas where we can let loose and areas where we're held back from fear of misbehaving. The risk of this understanding of discipline, today I get to see that the rebel inside me wants to break free from that. But the goal is to relate to discipline in a different way, that it said God will discipline us through 12 solutions to all of my problems today. To see this positive quality that actually allows me to grow, this internal mind and body environment, that connection to my soul, this discipline is from inner strength and wisdom. But me on my own device cannot have this inner strength and wisdom. My full-time career in politics should have given me that. My financial freedom should have given me that. My educated family members should have been given me that. But thank God for CA. Thank God for that one-tooth crackhead who would give me hope, where my fellow politicians and family members and educated friends couldn't. This internal strength that keeps me on the path of wisdom to trust this inner knowing, that intuition. That is God-given. Today, I get to know that as a felt experience. And today, I get to see that this discipline that I'm interested in is God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties. Not because I want to make more money, I want to have a better life, I want to have better clothes. No, take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, thy way of life. And then I ask for permission. May I do thy will always, always, always. That's the true discipline right there, where I get to come to the turning point. Is God concerned with us humans today? Well, us humans, do we want God enough? I can't speak for humans, but I can speak for myself when I didn't want God enough. In my false pride, arrogance, self-loathing, in my jealousy and distrust and suspicion, in my selfishness and my dishonesty, in my stealing, in my lying, in my exaggeration, in my intolerance and greed, in my lust and infidelity, in my hate and anger. One of my favorite drugs of choice. It says all other mind-altering substances, the biggest mind-altering substance for me is thoughts. That's where I get convinced that I am the defeated self. The false evidence appearing real. I think myself into conditions through the identification of what has defeated me. That's why I keep hearing God saying, "You are not that which defeats you, Kimya." Now my head seems to be interested in this defeated self, and that interest is what defeats me. My attention to that interest is what turns up the volume of the head. It's a subjective experience. There is no one standardized bottom in recovery, but this book in one of the stories says, have you tried to stop looking for the bottom? Stop digging for more. Yeah, cease fighting everything and everyone, but I don't cease fighting the cessation of thoughts, cessation of noise. I have a problem with cancellation of noise. And I'm a person of meditation, prayer. But do not be fooled, my friends. Even a person of peace has every single ability on earth to call on war. Now, we all possess the same raw materials to become combustible. What doesn't take me to that point is an existence of a power that is all-seeing, omnipotence. I get to be convinced to my demise. And when being convinced that something has defeated me, I become the witness of that defeat. I see it as a foreign subject, object to me. Something can change. Now I can be free from it. Because I can wake up with all kinds of positive affirmations, believing that today I'm going to be a great person. I'm not going to get angry. I'm not going to yell at anyone. I'm not going to character assassinate anyone in my head. By 12 o'clock, my shirt is touching me the wrong way. My pants don't fit me anymore. All of a sudden, bloodshed. I get to be a witness to that. The moment I get to be a witness of that which defeats me and I no longer identify with, I get to be free from it. And so, what I'm not is trying to get out as that which defeats me. It's an abject view, it's spiritless servility. That's why the solution of the spirit is the solution of the spirit. Because when I'm in the cabin of resentments, now who's running it? The defeat itself is running it. That which has defeated us. And how it has defeated us may look like 100 forms of fear, delusion, self-pity. But it's really one. It's that defeat itself. And I get to see where it says driven by. To be driven by means I am excluded from being in the driver's position. How can I be driven but also be driving the car? And so is that self-delusion really my delusion? No, it's self's delusion. It's the self diluting me. It's a delusion that's being imposed by me by an abject faith in self. My job is to see that God will help me in removing that which defeats me by no longer identifying with it. Where does it say in the big book that that's possible? Where it says you will lose interest in your own plans and designs, you will become more and more interested in that which can contribute to life. And so I can become less and less interested. That's the key formula for me today. At this point in my life, I get to see that once I give it no more attention, no more time, as Cameron has reminded me many, many times, give it no airtime, it will die. Give gossip no airtime. Give libel no airtime. You're at the center of defamation, give it no airtime. The more airtime you give it, the more legitimate it becomes, Kimia. And so I get to see. I get to see that there's a role of something else that is the defeat itself that defeats me. I also get to see the turning point that is hope. That is hope. That moment when I can see something else at play, that's when hope comes about. And the seed of that hope has been planted somewhere. That seed didn't get taken by the wind and dropped into the ocean. It didn't get picked up by a bird. Maybe if it did, it got pooped out and it got replanted again. But it got planted and it took time. It's not an overnight matter. I know that. But when I see that under the influence of this defeat itself, I show up as judgmental or the one who is the arbiter. I control, I micromanage, I martyr, I manage. I murder. And so I get to see this idea of self as trying to influence my ideas, my judgments, my decisions. No wonder I believe that this defeat itself speaks to me in my own words. Knows how to quote the big book beautifully. It also knows how to use the meditation sound of logic and reason to tell me I am right. Because the thing that has defeated me has found its Miracle-Gro. What is the Miracle-Gro? My attention, my interest in it. My attention and my interest used to be drugs, alcohol, people, places, things, drama. It grows itself. I'm either driven by self or a higher power. I cannot be driven by both. I can tell the difference in the drive. That's the difference today. And today I know that if I can't see the fruit, if I can't see the trees, I can see the fruits. If I can't see my higher power, I can see the miraculous demonstrations of his existence in my fellows. I get to ask others. I get to ask others, what am I missing here? What am I missing? You tell me, what is in my blind spot? I have a hard time even physically turning to my right side. Tell me what's on my right side. What am I not seeing? And so it says, I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. What does that look like for me today? It means that in my, what is actually used to be common sense, that is uncommon sense, is being responsible for you. I was responsible for you. You made me think that. You hurt my feelings. You embarrassed me. You caused me to do that. I take responsibility for others by micromanaging them. By changing or wanting to change their thoughts, feelings, and actions. Like going into the room, and the first thing I think is, how can I redecorate this room? No, that's not your job. Your job is to be present in the room as is. People pleasing, enabling, protecting, micromanaging, manipulating, over controlling, avoiding, dismissing, withdrawing, martyring, bullying, uncommunicative behaviors where I don't even owe you a response, because if you were smart enough, you should know. Cockiness. It says it's worse when it made us cocky. And so today I get to see that turning point, that my consciousness is driven towards a God consciousness, is when I am responsible for myself, my thoughts, my thinking, my feelings, my emotions, my behaviors. I get to be responsible. I get to be accountable. What am I doing in my step four? I get to be responsible and accountable, and I get to see it as a way of accessing a power beyond that defeat itself. That I will tell on you before you can tell on me. I like that. Preemptive. It's pretty nice. I get to be proactive. I get to be centered, a leader, a functional, loving, independent, and interdependent child of Earth. Whereas in my disease, I am unaccountable, I am irresponsible, I'm reactive, I'm uncentered, I'm a victim, I'm dysfunctional, I'm fearful, and I'm codependent. I look for my worth and value through your eyes. The turning point becomes a point where I turn to God for what is. That fearless proposition that God either is or God either is. I have no other way of reading this sentence anymore, my people. I mean, it says God either is or isn't, but to me, it's God either is, God has always been, or God will be. What was your pick to be? God is, God is, God is. And again, I've come a long way. I've made my amends with this word, God. Where I get to hand it all over to a power beyond me that is concerned with me. I have to draw near. I have to draw near. It's to my fellows that are new here, to my fellows that are returning, to my fellows that have relapsed, doing what we've always done, getting what we've always got. Thank you. Thank you for going out there and doing the research and telling us nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. Everything is just the way it was as you remember it. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 150 years ago, this disease would have given us the same results. To me today, those results are not worth the price I pay. It's not worth it anymore. And so thank you for coming back, because it does say we have to regard it in a different light. What is that light? That this apparent calamity has been a boon to us, for it actually leads us. It opened up a path which led to discovery of God. For many of us, it might be the rediscovery of us, of God. And you know what? It says it should not drag us down. Why does it drag me down? Because I'm listening to that defeat itself again. That says you're a piece of shit for not knowing how to. And you're absolute nothing if you didn't get it right. These are not true anymore. I just don't believe the lie anymore. And so it does not drag me down if I can capitalize on it. A better way of life will emerge because they will be overcome. Yes, they will be. I get to touch the grace of sanity today. And the biggest point of sanity for me today is the fact that I don't think I'm not insane anymore. My biggest insanity in this disease was that I thought I was sane. I came into the rooms knowing everything. I was badly mangled, but the cockiness and that ego was definitely the loudest. That's why I sat in the rooms of CA for 6 months just listening, generously listening, lending my ears to God, and lending my ears to the part of the liar that was actually a lot louder than God at points. But today I get to see that the louder the liar gets, chances are the better I'm doing in recovery. That it creeps right back in through doubt, apprehension, mental anxiety, when I'm actually getting better, you know? So to those of my fellows that think, I don't know, the liar is really loud. No, it's probably because you're doing better. This parasitical activity of self wants to take over again. And for me to be free from this parasitical activity of self, I have to realize I am the host, not the parasite. The parasite takes out the quality of the host where the host could be free from the parasite. So the last thing the parasite wants to deal with is a host who is not in that utter belief that it is the parasite, that I can walk away from it instead of walking towards it. I can lose interest in that which defeats me, gain interest in where I can be of contribution to my fellows. That neuterizes and neutralizes the disease very quickly. You know, the head that occupies the presence of these thoughts is now being filled up with space of contribution, helpfulness. It's no longer in overdrive activity mode. It can actually have more room to express itself through hope. To have moments of silence where silence becomes the most beautiful gift of life. And I can see that this experience that it talks about as not being missed is one that has to be felt. And so there will be workouts. It doesn't mean that, you know, the defeat itself is not going to show up. It will. I hope it does. Because if it doesn't, then I've gotten to the end of the internet and I know everything and I've seen every movie, every video, everything has been consumed. No, I want God to show me more. Because coming into the rooms of CA, I was perfect. I was actually convinced that I had everything right. And in that mode of thinking that I am perfect, I sought no help. But I had to be badly mangled to be able to say, I don't know what's wrong with me. Help me understand. And so today I get to help others who need to understand. Today I get to see that my sanity will still be there when I get that call that my mother has attempted suicide. Today I get to see that my sanity will still be there when I'm being told, you have cancer. Today I get to see that I still have my emotional sobriety when I'm given news of, you know, some of the closest family members no longer being here. And some of my closest family members being in the fellowship, they're just dead. Today, I get to see that this neutrality can remain if I continue to work this program of action, that God will show you how to have kimya. You're learning how to have. And you're learning how to have as a result of working this program as it's been prescribed. As it's been prescribed, but personalize it. Why not? Make it apply to you. And so I get to show up. I get to see things in a different light. I get to show up for service. The same workshop that I came into in person is online now. I get to be a part of that at on the last Sunday of the month, every month. I get to sit amongst others who actually want this way of life, who are breaking a cycle of absolute violence within themselves and in their family lines. And there is no greater feeling than that. And so, if you have a liar in your head that says this is not possible for you, every single speaker today has been a testimony that this is possible. And iron sharpens iron. Every single one of us sharpened one another as we passed it on so we can continue to have a full day of recovery. That is possible. as possible for me to have not finished the steps, to have not sponsored anyone, but be able to tell the newcomer where the bathrooms are, even though on the Zoom world you should know where your bathrooms are. But that this work is not mutually exclusive. I can be in the rooms and I can be online, and I can be forever thankful that this online space actually allows me to be amongst those who may have never had access to us and this recovery, and that I wouldn't have had access to them. To every single one of you, I get to have a fellow somewhere in this world. At any turning point, I can call someone who will tell me the truth and who will tell me where I'm being blinded by this defeat itself. I get to lean into that. And so I want to close us with a prayer that will come to my heart. I'm hopeful that someone in this room will find identification through this prayer. That I don't know what it's going to be, to be honest, but that's the power of prayers. That we just pray. We just pray and we just send grace. Let us take a deep breath in. God, thank you for allowing us to be together in the path that you have set for us. God, for thank you for allowing us to see the beauty of what you have created for us. God, thank you for giving us the power to hold with your hands, to see with your eyes, to hear with your ears. God, thank you for allowing us to feel unity, enthusiasm around our suffering and pain. God, thank you for allowing us to hold each other in the highest of regards, even if others can't. God, thank you for allowing us to see that your way of life can make this way of life possible for us. God, I pray that you will give courage, hope, and faith to the ones who have been dimmed, to the ones who do not have the privilege of having the solution. God, we thank you for giving us the courage to continue to serve you and those who are with eagerness interested in what this way of life has done for us. God, thank you for giving us the power of prayers for the ones that are at the gates of insanity and death. Prayers for our siblings who may never make it to a room like this. Prayers for our siblings who are in hospices and hospitals, those who have departed, those who will depart. God, give us the healings that we need in order to serve you. God, give us the power we need in order to see you. God, give us the hope that we need to plant a seed and watch its growth. God, we pray for the blessings of today's bread, for the food in our bellies, the clothes on our backs, the ceilings above our heads. God, allow us to give back to our homeless siblings, the ones who may have never experienced a moment of sanity, neutrality, or safety. God, we thank you for all that you have given, for all that we have continued to give back to you. Allow us to declare our readiness every day so we can serve a path which leads us back to you. Amen. Thank you, everybody, for allowing me to be of service to you today.